Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners and excess underwriters versus Franks.
May it please the court, Mr. Cliff Hall, the argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, there are three issues I wish to address in my argument this morning. First, of course, is the Matagorda County case and whether or not this court is going to determine to expand, restrict, or otherwise apply that case to the facts before it in the Franks case. We have set forth our position that the facts of this case are dramatically different than the facts were in Matagorda County, and that therefore, because of the facts of this case, that Matagorda should not control. Second issue I want to address is equity. If the lower court's ruling is affirmed, the result will be the Franks casing will realize a windfall of in excess of $7 million in insurance proceeds that it did not bargain for, it did not pay for, and it should not be entitled to. We think that is an unjust ruling, and we would urge the court not to allow that result to obtain. Third issue that I would like to address is the question of which state's law governs this issue and this dispute before this court today. The choice of law issue is a preliminary one that has to be reached in order for the court to decide the substantive law is going to apply to the case and the merits of the issues. We have urged the court in our brief that Louisiana law is applicable, but if Texas law applies, we still believe we should prevail on the facts. Let me first turn to Matagorda County. Matagorda was a different case than this case, and our facts are different in a material way. In Matagorda County, the insurer, TAC, was a primary carrier that had a defense obligation that, in fact, undertook the defense of the case, undertook unilateral settlement negotiations in which the insurer did not participate, and ultimately settled the case without consent of the insurer. They did so and were able to do so because the policy had a provision or did not have a provision requiring as the consent of the insurer to settle. So in that case, TAC was able to effectively ram a settlement down its insurer's throat. It was able to control the whole course of the litigation, the whole course of the settlement, and then settle the case without any participation from the insurer whatsoever. Our case is the exact opposite. We were excess carriers. We did not have a duty to defend. We did not defend the case.
Let's examine just the duty to defend, for example. You say you didn't have an obligation to defend Franks, but isn't it true, or I've read the briefs on the other side, that your policy gave you the right to associate with the insurer's defense and to compel Franks to cooperate in defense of the claim?
Yes, it is true.
Isn't that something like an entitlement to defend or to participate in defense?
It is, I believe, an entitlement to participate in the defense. That entitlement was not exercised except in the sense that additional counsel to defend the case was hired and paid for by the excess carrier. But the excess carrier in no way controlled the defense and, importantly, in no way controlled or even participated in the settlement negotiations. The settlement negotiations in this case were conducted that led to the conclusion of the case and settlement that we ultimately agreed to fund were conducted unilaterally by Franks. Franks obtained a demand within the settlement, within the policy limits, and then made the Stowers demand not once but twice on the insurer saying you need to settle the case.
Was there some time limit on that settlement demand? It was in trial.
Your Honor, I'm not positive that there was or there wasn't. I don't recall anything in the record. Obviously, they were in trial, so there was some exigency in terms of resolving
the case. Had there been settlement negotiations prior to that you were aware of? Or was the case nowhere and then it settled?
There had been settlement negotiations during the year or whatever it was that the underlying case was pending.
And were those within an amount that would have called upon the excess carrier to participate?
There was one demand that was made for $9.9 million that potentially was within a Stowers demand. The issue is what, how much of the underlying had been eroded. So whether or not there was a full $10 million available and the 9.9 came in within. But that demand for 9.9 was rejected by Franks. Franks was handling the case. They said, we're not interested in 9.9. They went to trial, and things got worse. And they realized at trial, that after I think it was 2 days of trial, that they got a lot more concerned about the case and what was going to happen to them. And so at that point, they solicited the settlement demand to settle the case.
Did I see in the record that there had been, that the excess carrier had made an offer that was more than this one was at some point prior?
The settlement negotiations were undertaken by the attorney for the excess carrier. I believe it was prior to the trial. And he tried to settle the case in a number of different ways. I mean, he talked about settling with contribution from Franks. He talked about settling only what he believed to be the covered claims. My view is those claims, those negotiations, never really reached fruition. And so I'm not sure that they really have any impact on the court's decision.
But again, was there an offer from the excess carrier to settle for more than what they ultimately settled for?
The only offer I'm aware of that was a comprehensive offer to settle the entire case was the 9.9. And that was rejected by Franks.
I guess what I'm getting at, and maybe Justice O'Neill as well, is what opportunity you may have had to seek some type of declaration as to your exposure.
Well, the court, there was an opportunity. I guess there's always an opportunity. The court, of course, in the Gandy and Griffith decisions has suggested that that's a justiciable issue and that is something that sure.
It seems to me to be pretty thoroughly eroded. It was from a time, fireman's fund. It's from a time when declaratory judgments were relatively new in Texas and the Constitution read somewhat differently, and on top of that, it was wrong.
To answer your question, there was time for them to seek relief and file a DJ. The DJ was not filed until the settlement had been agreed. An insurer stands.
And how much time did it take from the time filing the suit till the trial started?
Your Honor, I don't know. I would presume it was a couple of years. Somewhere between a year and two. I just don't know exactly how long that was. Insurer.
Can you tell me what the coverage dispute was?
Sure. Franks was sued for. Franks fabricated a structure that was going to be a support base for an offshore platform. They went out and installed it, and then they returned later to build the structure on top of that to find that the structure that Franks had fabricated collapsed. It was gone. There was no bodily injury, no personal injury, property damage, other than the collapse of Frank's structure. The CGL policy at issue, as almost all CGL policies that I've seen, had a products and completed operations exclusion because they're going to insure for property damage, physical injury, personal injury, those kinds of things. But it's not a bond to guarantee the performance of Frank's own work. And so those kinds of policies typically don't cover. And Judge Work had no trouble finding on motion that there was no coverage.
This isn't the type of case where you have to try the suit first to determine to litigate your deck action. It's pretty clear cut. I mean,
it depends at what stage you're looking at, Your Honor. If you're as standing representing an insurer and a lawsuit gets filed, you have a claim and you've got allegations in a petition, but until a record is developed and you get to see, sort of fill in the flesh on the bones of what's alleged, maybe you can make a case that can be easily and quickly disposed of, maybe you can. In this case, we have the benefit of all of the underlying discovery that went on throughout the course of the trial. And then the testimony and evidence that was put on the first two or three days of trial. So it's easy to sit here in hindsight and say that could have been resolved very early. An insurer, I think, rightfully, generally the insurers.
Well, I mean, I guess maybe that depends on the particular case.
It does.
In Gandy, we did put forth that is a preferred method to do it, and if it can be done, and we emphasize that in Matagorda, that the insurer has an option to be able to go in there and do that. And it sounds to me that the exclusion that you're relying on is fairly clear cut, and so I don't know why it doesn't fit within those two cases? I mean, I understand when you say there can be a compelling case where you don't know if the underlying case is fully tried, where the exclusion is going to lie. Of course, if there's duty to defend, it gets a little more complicated. But I don't understand why, if it's a pretty clear-cut exclusion, why the better course is not to go in and get the insurer to go in there, get that determined right off the bat, and then it's done.
Well, I think it's a pretty clear cut that that's the right way to approach it today in light of Matagorda County. Of course, the case was not had not been decided at the time that all this activity occurred. And what I think was going on is, I mean, if you look at the Gandy decision, you say we've got a right, an insurer has a right to litigate coverage. If it believes that there is a dispute about coverage, it has a right to litigate coverage. Something happened to that right, apparently, in this case. Because you go from having a right to litigate coverage without consent, by the way, of the insured. You didn't have a consent to that, nor without any provision in the policy saying you have a right. You have a right because there's a contract between the parties, and there's a right to determine what the contract means to the parties. Now, somehow along the line, that right that my client would have had and had, I guess, to litigate coverage was lost. Now, it wasn't lost because of a waiver.
Well, this is kind of the ground we've crossed a lot in Matagorda County, that both sides are in an untenable position. It's in the insurer's best interest to, if you've got a deep pocket, which presumably there is one here for your insured, and you can recover reimbursement, you have an incentive to get it resolved within policy limits to protect yourself from a Stowers claim. And however much you end up paying doesn't really matter if you can get reimbursement. So there's no incentive, really, on the insurer's part to effectuate the lowest settlement possible because you're protected under Stowers and you can get fully reimbursed if there's no coverage. The insured has problems, and you've got problems, and both sides have problems however you come out on it. And in Matagorda, we acknowledged that and said we think the better course is to put the risk, because if we put it where you want it, you've got to acknowledge that there are situations where it puts the insured in a completely untenable position.
Well, I'm not sure I would acknowledge that. And let me tell you why I think that the Matagorda, as it currently stands, is not, it really doesn't serve the purposes this court has articulated the objective this court has articulated of trying to achieve swift resolution of litigation. I'm involved in some litigation right now where there is a significant underlying dispute about alleged securities fraud, and it involves damages alleged to be in excess of $100 million. There's a coverage dispute. All right, now, we have to now file a DJ. And under Matagorda as it stands, we have to litigate the DJ. The insurer doesn't want to litigate on two fronts. They don't want to have to fight for 2 years this serious securities litigation and at the same time fight their insurer. All right, but we can't be put in the position of getting to the end of the day and having the dilemma that Matagorda presents. Matagorda in conjunction with Stowers, the dilemma that is presented for an insurer. We are going to try to beat their litigation.
Yeah, and the premise of my question is you're in a dilemma there. The insurers are in dilemmas. I mean, we've struggled with how do you allocate this risk. If we do it all one way, there's going to be problems. If we do it all the other way, there are going to be problems. And so how do we thread this needle? There's been an amicus brief filed that proposes a solution. Can you kind of address that?
Well, I don't. I agree with the problem that the amicus brief notes. I don't really agree with the solution. Their solution is to change Stowers. And I, honestly, we've lived with Stowers for a long time now, and I think all sides are generally comfortable with what it means and how you deal with it and can deal with it. My proposal would be more along the lines of what Justice Owens said in her dissent in Matagorda County, where she noted that the language is broader than it needs to be. And then in a very prescient way went on to articulate almost our case. And a situation where an insured controls settlement, demands settlement, accepts the benefit of settlement, why should that then enable them to get out
of... So you are going over the same grounds we covered in Matagorda.
No, well, in the sense of the issues, certainly, but our facts are different.
Mr. Hall, let me piggyback on that point. In your opinion, what were the driving the fundamental tenets of Matagorda? Not its holding, but what drove it? Obviously, the court was concerned about conflict of interest here, or in that case. It seems to me there was some concern about there being no contractual right to reimbursement in that case. And maybe there was some mention about the fact that this perhaps common law reimbursement claim was not established in the record of that case. Were there other things that were driving Matagorda's determination, in your opinion?
Well, when I read the appellate court case, underlying case, and this court's case, our opinions, it seems to me that the driving concern was, and I can understand it, the court didn't like how TAC was in the driver's seat and able to manipulate the entire course of that case. They handled the defense. They handled the settlement. They took a settlement that they didn't get approval for from their insured. They did everything. And then they turned around and said, we want our money back now. That concern is not present in our facts. Our facts, as I've already stated, will repeat, but are completely different facts.
Okay, so then you're arguing that Matagorda County doesn't apply, and in looking at that, I'm very concerned about the underpinnings, the reasoning for why Matagorda County was decided the way it was. Now, viewing that being the case, let's view the factual distinctions or consider the factual distinctions in light of whether they change the underpinnings for this case compared to Matagorda County. The factual distinctions, I understand them here, are that there was no duty to defend or control the defense.
Correct.
On behalf of your client, different from Matagorda County. There was no Stowers demand in Matagorda County. There was one here.
Correct.
You argue the insured organized the settlement. I think you used the term orchestrated, and I understand there was an exception taken to that terminology.
Correct.
And the other difference, material difference, was, or important difference perhaps, that in Matagorda County, the insurer had the right to settle without the insured's consent, which wasn't present here. Those are four significant, perhaps material, perhaps not, distinctions. Analyze those in light of the underpinnings of Matagorda County. Not its holding, but the reason it came out the way it did. Which of those are important and why?
I think all of those
are
important.
That's a small question, I know.
It is a small question, especially with the red light on. I think all of those are significant issues which the court was troubled, I believe, by how the insured was basically left helpless. Now, I have to say that honestly, if I look at this court's opinion in Matagorda County, I'm troubled by the notion of consent to a lawsuit. I'm troubled by the notion that the court starts to talk about the issue of whether or not the insured consents to this reimbursement claim. I don't know why it is that consent is an issue to litigation when the court has already articulated in Gandy that there is a right to litigate coverage. All right, but I'm also concerned about the notion of subrogation, because I clearly agree with the court that there is no subrogation right that an underwriter has against its insured in these circumstances. I don't know what the lawyers argued in that case, but I suspect that was it. The reason I say that is I think it is. Those discussions, to me, suggest that the court was so troubled by what had happened to this insured and the way in which the course of litigation went on that they were looking at the issue and concerned about not wanting to allow that type of conduct to occur in the future.
Well, let me follow up on that. You talked about the specter of litigation hanging out over the insured. And that kind of impinges on touches on the conflict of interest concern in Matagorda County expressed. Well, in this case, with the Stowers demand, parties know there's some adversarial relationship here. Maybe it'll rise to the level of lawsuit, maybe it won't. So there's nothing unfair about the parties knowing that they're in the same boat together in terms of trying to resolve the case, or perhaps having to pay parts or all of a judgment, but they know there's also going to be some dispute because of the Stowers demand. So that at least is a much lessened consideration in this case than in Matagorda County. Do you agree?
Sure.
What about the fact that there was no contractual right to reimbursement? Is that the same consideration here as in Matagorda County?
Well, I think that's the heart of the issue, is whether there is a contractual right to reimburse. But there was no policy statement that there was a right to reimbursement if an underwriter funded a claim. That was not the policy. I've never seen an insurance policy that says that.
Well, and isn't that the fundamental holding? It was that you can't reserve something that's not in the policy. There is no policy right to reimbursement. You can't create it by purporting to reserve it. And therefore, we were left with, are we going to imply such a right under these equitable sort of circumstances? And we determined if we do it this way, it's going to be inequitable. If we do it that way, it's going to be inequitable. There are problems whichever way we put it. So we've got to come down somewhere, and let's put it on the party that's better able to assume the risk.
Well, two things. One, I don't think that that what you're trying to reserve with the reservation of rights letter is a right to reimbursement that's not in policy. I think what you're reserving is what this court has recognized as a right to litigate coverage in a DJ. And you're saying, listen, I'm getting ready to fund this settlement. That could be considered an act that is not consistent with the position of non-coverage that we take. And I don't want any mistake.
The insurer has a choice. They can either go get the deck action done, in which event, if there's clearly no coverage, they can do that. Or they can decide to go forward without pushing the deck action. And if they settle it, they settle the whole thing. And they just realize they're doing that, that there's going to be a coverage dispute, and they're getting rid of the whole thing.
They do have that choice, maybe. I mean, you're assuming that you can file a DJ and get it heard, and get it heard before the underlying dispute is resolved. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. All right, it's possible. All right, we're trying to do it in the case I mentioned earlier. But it's not serving, I mean, it's good for lawyers. You know, it fosters litigation, and we're filing DJs that we would not have otherwise filed, compelled by not wanting to wait and be dealt with the dilemma that Matagorda County presents. And so if that's what the court's ruling is that if the court wants to say, look, it's up to the insurers, your professionals, y'all deal with this however you want, then it will be more
detailed.
But
one of the premises was, too, that when you are in that position, you are settling with what you consider to be the insured's money. And you shouldn't be able to settle with the insured's money without the insured's consent to the amount.
That was Matagorda. That's not our case.
Well, it is. If you say we're going to settle it and seek reimbursement, you're saying this is ultimately your money.
Well, we got a demand to settle. We got several demands to settle. We got Stylerized asking us to settle.
Right.
I don't see how that could be us saying we're settling with your money. The insurance has settled this case, and if you don't, you're going to be liable for extra contractual damages. They said it twice. And we argued with them about it. We talked about how we might do it in a lot of different ways. But they were insistent. Settle the case, and they accepted the benefit of the money. And there's now been a ruling by Judge Work they weren't entitled to the money. Now, I don't see how what the court's trying to accomplish is served in Frank's case. I understand, and it's consistent with the court's opinion in Rocor and earlier opinions in Garcia. The court is concerned with insurers getting in and running roughshod over the case. And if you jump in, even if you don't have a defense obligation, if you jump in and start participating in defense or settlement, you better do it right or else you can be liable. I have no problem with that. All right, it makes sense to me. And as a person who represents insurers, they can live with that. The problem is, in this case, they didn't do any of those things. None of that happened, and they got hoisted on the horns of a dilemma by the combination of what this court says in Matagorda and Stavros. So they had to either settle, and if they settle, they lose their right to litigate coverage, or not settle, and if they don't settle, they expose themselves to damages in excess of policy limits.
So on the issue of the concern in Matagorda County about the insurer being able to manipulate the case and the outcome, that falls away here because Frank's issued a Stowers demand, and Frank's, you say, orchestrated the settlement.
The record, I think, is pretty clear on that point. The settlement was obtained by Frank's in-house counsel. He requested a settlement demand within policy limits. He got one, and then he turned around and said, settle this case. Wrote a Stowers letter the same day. There was some discussion about it. There was some offers made about funding it and maybe let's find a way to go forward in arbitration or other things. Frank refused, wrote a second demand saying, settle this case. Ma'am.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Warren Harris will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The issue in this case is whether the insured or the insurer should face the difficult choice when settling a claim for which coverage is disputed. This court set forth the right test in Matagorda County and should apply that test in this case.
But do you agree, Mr. Harris, that there are some factual, important factual distinctions in this case from Matagorda County? Whether they're outcome determinative or material to the legal outcome, I'm not sure yet. But there's some important factual differences.
There are some distinctions, and yes, just as the Court of Appeals found, we don't think they're material, but there are a few factual distinctions here.
What about the underlying driving underpinnings of Matagorda County? I've talked to Mr. Hall about a couple at length, the conflicts issue that Matagorda County specifically talks about. And then Mr. Hall brought up the risk of the insurer manipulating the case. He claims the conflicts issue, and I agree, is less of a concern here. Because with the Stowers demand, you know there's going to be a conflict, and you should, to some level, and the parties are on notice to act accordingly. What about the manipulate the case underlying issue in Matagorda County, if that was part of the job of the concern?
I think that is one of the concerns. One of the concerns in Matagorda County, Goldberg, one of the Massachusetts Supreme Court cases relied on, you were looking at a situation where the insurer was acting unilaterally. In this case, it is slightly different because it was a Stowers demand made. But the Stowers demand was settle this case because it's a covered claim. That was a demand that everyone concedes is reasonable, so there was no manipulation by the insured trying to get some sort of a sweetheart deal and set up the insurer. There was a Stowers demand to settle the case because it was a reasonable settlement and it was a covered claim that should have been settled with the insurer's money.
You say it's about assigning risk, but isn't it true that if the insured is wrong and the insurer turns it down, there's a coverage litigation and it's decided adversely to the insured, the insured's out the money.
The insured is out the money, yeah, in that situation? If there is no settlement and there is no coverage, ultimately that issue is litigated, it will be the insured that's exposed.
But if the insurer is wrong, there will be additional bad faith damages.
I believe the damages are more likely to be Stowers in the event there's an excess judgment. I guess possibly there could be some 2121 or other liability.
But isn't every insured going to sue for extra contractual damages?
I think it's likely that you will see that, but in the context of what we're talking about, you know, unless they've done other things wrong in settling it, you're looking at the indemnity claim, you're looking at Stowers for an excess judgment, and then if they didn't act reasonably, there may be potential exposure under 2121. Let's walk through the process in Matagorda County to show what happens. Whenever there's a dispute over coverage, the first thing the insurer should do, as this court has said in prior cases, to file a declaratory judgment action. Chief Justice Phillips, you asked about the time span of the case pending. They sent a reservations of rights letter in March of 1997. They didn't file the deck judgment action until after they settled the case in February of 1998. So there was an 11-month window that they did nothing to try to get it resolved by declaratory judgment.
You agree that the insured could have, Franks could have filed the declaratory judgment action as well?
I think Franks could have, but I think this court has said in Griffin and Gandy and Matagorda County that that's something the insurer should try to do is to get that resolved.
Do you agree with counsel that there may be instances, maybe common, that the insured wouldn't want to be in a declaratory judgment action over coverage at the same time that he's in a suit against somebody that's after him?
It might be possible. I'm not sure that's really the case because often the parties in the underlying case do want to get it resolved because they think there's coverage. If they think there's no coverage, that might be a slightly different situation. But
well, I'm just saying, if the defendant wins the day against the plaintiff, then he doesn't have to pay for his expenses in the declaratory judgment action.
And the problem that you're talking about, sometimes the insured might not want that to go forward. An easy Rule 11 would take care of that. All you need is a Rule 11 agreement saying it is agreed by the parties that we are not going to go forward in a declaratory judgment proceeding, and the insured shall not use that in any way against the insurer as the waiver of any rights this proceeding or any other proceeding, and it's done. I think the insured and insurer can agree to that. So if it's something,
so then what happens? We get to here, and you send us Dower's demand and say settle, and the insurance company says no coverage.
Well, it does get us here, and I don't think that's what parties should do. But if it's going to prejudice the insured, and they're basically saying, well, sometimes we don't want to do that because it's going to prejudice the insured, that can be accommodated. I don't think that ought to be encouraged. I think they ought to be encouraged to file.
There would be no incentive for the insurance company to ever do a Rule 11 agreement because it doesn't resolve the problem they're trying to get resolved.
It doesn't, and they might assert their rights to go forward and do it. I'm not saying they would have to do it, but they would be able to accommodate. You're right. They should go forward and try to get that resolved so when they get in this situation, they've got coverage to turn.
So what happens if the declaratory judgment action doesn't get resolved? They file it 2 weeks after the underlying lawsuit's filed, and the underlying lawsuits, you're in the middle of trial, you get a settlement offer, and the deck action's not resolved, then what?
If it doesn't get resolved, you go to the next step in the decisional process. The insurer should try to get the insured to consent to a right of reimbursement. If they do that, no problem.
It's the insurer here trying to get you to consent, trying to get an agreement to hold this.
Yes, but I really need to explain that, Judge, because I don't think that's exactly accurate. They faxed us a letter at 9 a.m. on February 23rd for the first time ever in this case, in any manner, said, we're going to settle this case, but we are coming after you for reimbursement.
Now, let's go back and review the bidding. That bothers me about your bidding. A reservation of rights, we all know what that means. That means you owe the money, we don't.
Right.
And there had been structured settlements. One proposal before trial was we'll fund it, but you'll fund part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can really sit here and say you were shocked the insurance company would propose settling it and seek reimbursement.
I didn't necessarily say we're shocked, Judge, but I think a reservation of rights letter saying there's no coverage is different than reimbursement, because what that means, the reservation of rights letter, is if this case goes to judgment, don't come looking to me. You're going to be on the hook for it if it goes to judgment. Settling the case brings in new ramifications, and reimbursement is a new right that's different than simply saying, when you come to me for indemnity, I'm not going to pay it.
But you demanded they make the settlement, and you approved this specific amount.
Demanded that they make the settlement under Stowers, as we were entitled to do. Everybody agrees it's a reasonable settlement. It was an offer lower than they had tried to settle the case for, so there's no dispute. We did approve the amount. But again, the Stowers demand was that they settle the case as a covered claim. They then that morning responded.
You're in a lot better shape than you would be with a reservation of rights, a case to trial, and a $20 million judgment. You talk about this bringing up these new exposures that Stowers demand not complied with, and has more
Chief,
downside risk.
We may or may not be. And let me shift over to one of the problems why I think reimbursement really is a different situation than simply having a reservation of rights. Whenever the case is settled, you're fixing liability, if you will, and you're certainly fixing the amount of damages that are owed. And the question is, well, aren't you in a better position by having a $7.5 million judgment where you litigate or a settlement where you litigate the coverage issue, as opposed to going to trial and possibly being hit for $10 or $20 million. Well, in that situation, you have to look at what the insured's options are. One option is to say, yes, I'll consent, go settle the case. If there's no coverage, I'll reimburse you. But in doing that, the insured has to sit there and say, wait a minute, that settlement might be three times my net worth, and I don't want to do that. I've got
Are you saying if you thought there was any right to reimbursement, you would not have encouraged, demanded, and approved the settlement? You would roll the dice?
Judge, the record is silent on that in this case because we never had the chance to respond. They said, we're going to seek reimbursement, and literally within no more than 3 hours, they had the case settled. We never had a chance to respond to that, to make the decision whether we were or were not going to.
So much of this problem underlying, I think, all these cases is the settlement negotiations look entirely different based on whether there's coverage or whether there's not coverage. If there's a deck action and it's been declared there is no coverage here, a plaintiff is going to presumably put a much lesser demand on a defendant that's not covered. And so they just take on two entirely different dynamics. So
that's exactly right. When they think there's a $10 million policy, that's going to be one demand. Whenever they've got a defendant with a net worth of a few hundred thousand or a few million dollars possibly, that's going to be another demand. Because if the net worth of the defendant is $2 or $3 million, In that situation, the defendant's got a different analysis.
Is your client's net worth in there?
Judge, it's not in the record. No, it's not in the record. But I think in fashioning the rule, the court needs to look at the context various insureds are going to be in. Sometimes the settlement is in an amount that the insured could pay and would be willing to pay to make the case go away. But I think there are a lot of other situations where insurance exceeds a company's net worth. That's why you have the insurance for the catastrophic claim, that you may have a $10 million policy and you may have $1 million or $2 or $5 million net worth. And so even if you wanted to, it might be a very reasonable settlement. And even if you wanted to, you can't get out your checkbook and write a check and pay it because it exceeds your net worth.
In terms of the equities here, the petitioner frames the case as one where respondent received a $7.5 million windfall. No right or entitlement to it since there's no coverage, or if there's no coverage, but it's entirely a windfall. Sounds like I'm going to make some presumptions from what I've heard from you that this equity shouldn't be considered just in terms of whether there was coverage for the settlement, but it should be considered in light of the possible payment that the insured and the insurer were both potentially looking at if there was a huge judgment there. So it could have been a net savings of $7 million if the judgment was $14.5 versus just an out-of-pocket $7.5 million payment.
That's right, Judge. And I think there are three considerations to take into account here in balancing the equities. First is that excess underwriters received a benefit. Excess underwriters cut off any potential Stowers liability. They cut off any defense costs. They took all of that out of the picture when they made the decision that we don't know if there's coverage here or not. We're disputing that with the insured, but we're going to pay this judgment. It did it to protect its own interest. That's why the judgment was paid. Then you look at the rights taken away from the insured. Whenever they unilaterally said, we're going to settle this case, but we're coming after you for reimbursement. They added that new term.
But you demanded that they settle the case.
We demanded that they settle the case as a covered claim, Judge, which is, again, different. Whenever I'm sitting there as the insured and I've got to look at a demand on me, whether I choose to accept it or not, assuming it's an objectively reasonable demand, let's assume in this case, because I think all parties have, the $7.5 million is objectively reasonable, but it might otherwise be a claim that the insured still is not going to take. Just because it's a reasonable demand doesn't mean the defendant's going to accept it. The obvious reason we've talked about is it exceeds their net worth and they can't pay it. But there may be other reasons they choose not to pay it out of their assets. So making the demand on the insured is a right under Stowers. And that's one of the other...
But it's not a right if there's no coverage, right?
There is not a determination, and no one at that point knows if there's coverage.
Well, did the policy provide coverage or not?
According to Judge Work, no, and that issue's not there.
Did you contest that conclusion? Did you appeal it in any way?
We did not appeal it. We did litigate it in the trial court, but it was not appealed.
Why didn't you take it up on appeal?
Judge, the notice of appeal was filed before I was retained in the case.
Okay, and assuming that there's no coverage, do you agree? Assuming that there's no coverage, do you agree that underwriters then paid a debt it didn't owe, or paid on a claim that it for which there was no coverage at all? So it's a windfall. In other words, it's Justice Wainwright's.
I don't know that I would characterize it as a windfall. I think in terms of unjust enrichment and all the doctrines that follow.
Well, there's no coverage, so they had no obligation to pay under the contract, but
Right. They
paid $7.5 million.
Correct.
Isn't that right? Isn't there something a little bit unfair about it?
Well, Judge, that's why we have to look at the whole picture. And we start with they received benefits. And this was not a gratuitous payment. The insurance company paid it because they didn't know whether there was coverage or not.
Yeah, but let's assume that Franks made a complete analysis of the coverage issue and knew there was no coverage, and that other things being equal, it was responsible for all the damages above the primary amounts. Under your theory, what would stop Franks from refusing, and unreasonably so, to recognize underwriters' claim for reimbursement if they were to pay money toward that settlement?
If they...
Just to get, again, to get the get that money paid using the insurer's money, not...
If they knew they had no coverage, I agree. I don't think there is an incentive for them to go in and seek reimbursement, but you've got to remember the insurer is making the choice. And if Franks knows that there's no coverage, you bet the insurance company is going to know it. And if there's no coverage, as you just said, there's no Stowers liability, there's no indemnity liability. If the insurance company knows that there is no coverage, they have the option to do nothing.
Let me ask about, y'all went into open court after the settlement had been reached, and at that point you knew there was a reservation that they were making a demand for reimbursement, but Franks chose to go forward with the settlement anyway. Isn't that correct?
Franks basically read the Rule 11 agreement that was entered into between underwriters and the plaintiffs in the underlying case. That was read into the record. Franks put on the record its objection to any claim that underwriters had.
But it didn't say stop the settlement. It didn't say, wait a minute, if there's even a possibility that I'm going to be put on the hook for this settlement, I want to stop the settlement. So Franks agreed to go forward knowing that there was this claim out there.
Franks did nothing to stop the settlement, and I don't think Franks could have stopped the settlement.
The policy requires Franks' consent to settlement, does it not?
Judge, let's look at what the consent is. It's on page 330 of the record, and it's a very limited consent. That provision deals with getting paid back when you pay a claim. Page 330 of the record, paragraph J at the top. The first sentence says, the only way you're entitled to benefits under this policy is if you have paid them first. You are entitled to be indemnified, but you pay them first. The second sentence says, a claim for indemnity must be made within 12 months of, one, the case being resolved by judgment, or two, the case being resolved by an agreement between underwriters, the assured, Franks in this case, and the claimant in the underlying case. The only consent, and that's the only consent provision in this policy, says if you are going to pay a claim, you have to make the demand to be reimbursed for that within 12 months of this agreement. There is nothing in the policy that requires Franks to consent in the situation we've got here where the insurer is paying the claim directly. So there is a consent provision, but it's very limited. The underwriters went out and settled this claim on its own. They picked up the phone. They called the plaintiff, and they settled the case. They then sent a letter.
You're saying that they had a contractual right. If Franks had objected to the settlement and said, no, Judge, we want to go forward with the trial, you're saying the insurance company had the right to settle it over Franks' objection.
I think it's a practical matter. I'm not sure there was a contractual right, but I think they had it because they had an agreement with the plaintiff. And the plaintiff says, Judge, I want their money. Judge Link, I want their money. I've got an agreement with them to pay me. I want their money, and I'm non-suiting this case. I don't know how Franks can stop that. They could have settled this case.
Let me ask you about the declaratory judgment action again. Ordinarily, if the issue is a defense, we have the eight corners rule, and that's pretty much going to be a legal question every time. You're going to look at the policy. You're going to look at the pleadings. You're not going to look at the evidence unless there's some sham or fraud or something going on. And you're going to make a decision about a defense based on that. But coverage, you would have to get into the details of the claim, I guess. Is that true?
It's possible that you would. They had several different defenses. They alleged about a dozen different defenses, and many of them, like the own product exclusion.
Franks, you mean?
I'm sorry?
Franks did?
Underwriters had asserted several exclusions as a defense to coverage in this case. So there were many. And so I don't think it's crystal clear whether it could or could not have been litigated. I think it probably could have been litigated as a debt judgment, but they didn't even try to do that.
But at least if there are going to be problems with litigating coverage, I take it, in a lot of cases where you're going to, in essence, you're going to have to put the plaintiff on the stand and find out exactly what the plaintiff's case is, and there may be some conflict as that develops between the insurer and the insured over what they want the plaintiff to say, I take it.
In some situations, it may be a conflict where you can't. In this case, I think they could have litigated it. And again, it goes back to they didn't try. Had they gotten down into court and the judge says, I've got to stay this because it's too complicated, I have to abate it, they would be here saying, at least we tried.
So it's not just purely a question of legal justiciability in the sense that something has to go first. It's a problem. They're more of a practical problem of whether how it's going to be done.
I think that's right, and whether it can, in many instances it can. There may be some where it can.
It was just justiciable here, you said.
I believe it was, yes.
Why? Under what case? I mean, the primary coverage hadn't been exhausted, and so what gives excess the right to bring deck action?
Well, you look at all the demands that were being made, all the settlement demands that were going back and forth. Chief Justice Phillips asked this. They were all up in the $7, $8, $9 million range. Everybody was operating, and the demands going back and forth, the condition was primary is going to be tendered. Everybody was operating as if primary would go into it, and in fact it did. A big portion of primary had already been exhausted through defense costs. So that they were in trying to get the case settled too. Everybody realized this was going to, unless there was a take-nothing judgment, this was going to go into excess level.
But was the coverage issue, was it a legal question, or were there fact issues to be resolved?
I believe many of them were legal questions that you can determine from the eight corners rule.
But were there any fact issues?
It wasn't litigated, so I can't say that for sure, Judge.
Any other questions?
Yes, just one. Mr. Harris, what law applies, Texas or Louisiana, and does it make any difference?
Texas law applies because they didn't raise Louisiana law in the trial court. They didn't ask the trial court to apply Louisiana law. There's been no showing of conflict because Louisiana has not decided this decision. California, Massachusetts, a few other jurisdictions have reached this issue, but Louisiana has not decided the question. And they want the court to make an eerie guess under Louisiana law.
Mr. Harris, do you see any way to ensure that the coverage issue is decided prior to the point in time where there's tension over the settlement?
I think the only thing the court can do is what it did in Griffin and Gandy and Matagorda and tell the insurer that you've got to do to go out and try to get it resolved. You can't ensure that's going to happen in every situation, and that's the best you can do is to try to get it resolved. And in many cases, you could. Here we had an 11-month window. It's very likely they could have filed a summary. I mean, all they had to do is file the debt judgment, get summary judgments on file, and get a ruling.
If you had appealed that and so it had not been a final judgment, who bears the cost of that delay?
I don't know that anyone's bearing the cost. It just doesn't get the issue resolved.
If it's not resolved, but they did everything they could, they sent you a letter and 5 minutes later filed a declaratory judgment action, and you stall it. You lose and you appeal. And do they still pay the judgment with no recourse, or have they done everything they can?
Judge,
will abide the result of that declaratory judgment action, even if it comes after the settlement?
They do have recourse because they have to go through the right steps and ensure the insured is protected. And under Matagorda County, said...
My question is very simple. They took our advice in Gandy and they filed a declaratory judgment, but it's not resolved prior to the time they have to make a Stowers decision. Did they get to continue and get the declaratory judgment resolved, and that determines whether or not you reimburse, or are they out of luck under your reading of Matagorda?
They're not out of luck under my reading of Matagorda just because they didn't do that, because they didn't follow the other steps in Matagorda or any other rule, even the California rule in Jacobson. They didn't follow those steps. They waited 11 months before doing it, and in fact, they had already agreed to the Sowers demand.
I'm going to try my question one more time, then I'll give up. But if an insurer in the position that Excess was in had filed a declaratory judgment action, would it have to be finally resolved, the final judgment and appeals exhausted, before the case gets to a point that it settles, in order for them to have any? If it's not finally resolved, and they make the payment because they're in a Stowers situation, can they have any right to reimbursement against you if they end up winning the declaratory judgment that is resolved later, or are they out of luck?
They can have the right to reimbursement if they have met the other requirements that have been imposed, either through Matagorda or whatever rule in that jurisdiction. They have to do other things.
But that brings up the whole question. The other Matagorda County requires that the insured agree that they can seek reimbursement. So we'd be back to the same point. I think your answer to the chief is no.
What other things would they have to do that they could do? Excess in the question he asked.
Well, to file the declaratory judgment action. Well, they didn't do it timely, but they...
His question says they did.
Okay, they did it, but I still think the court has said you need to do it in a timely manner. But
okay.
Moving forward from that, under Matagorda County, you have to get the consent of the insured.
Right.
If you don't do that, you then need to make the choice whether it's covered or not, or whether you want to risk Stowers exposure. You may make the choice that you didn't if you look at the
calendar. It would be malpractice if you represented a surety to ever give that consent, I guess.
I think there are situations where you would give the consent. If it is a loser case for liability, why go through the hassle? Why put your company through the exposure of the judgment, put all of your witnesses through the length of the trial and the disruption of your business? If it's a good settlement for, you know, pick a number. In this case, it was $7.5 million. And if that is a number that you're willing to pay if there's no coverage, and I think I've got a horrible liability case, and I think I've got a pretty good coverage case. I think there's coverage here. Of course I would consent, because I'm using the insurance company's money to satisfy this case while I get to go litigate a coverage claim with them that I think I'm going to win. So I think there certainly are situations where the insured would reasonably consent to it.
It looks to me like if you don't consent, not only are you going to win the coverage case, that's what you think, but you're going to win extra contractual damages, and the insurer is going to be on the hook for the Stowers.
If you go forward with the litigation, and in this situation they settled it out because they didn't have the option to go forward, and that's one of the other evils under Matagorda County that the court's addressing, just as the California Supreme Court did in Jacobson, and you're balancing the rights by allowing a unilateral settlement and a unilateral reservation of rights, the universal reservation of the right to reimbursement, you're depriving the insured of the ability to go forward. And that's not in the contract.
Well, and it strikes me that it's skewed whatever you do, because, I mean, in practicality, and I've said this before, if it's not the insurance company's money, then the settlement, let's say the company has a net worth of $1 million, plaintiffs are going to settle that case with the company for probably $800,000. If there's the aura of there being insurance money out there, there's going to be a $9 million that the insurer can't pay. So it's dilemmas all the way around.
That's right, Judge. It is skewed a bit, but we have to remember where Stowers fits into this picture. And so, first of all, you've got the insured with the ability to make a Stowers demand. And crafting another rule, a rule other than Matagorda County, is going to erode Stowers.
But Stowers presupposes that the insurer has control of the defense and the exclusive right to settle, neither of which is applicable here.
They didn't have exclusive control of the defense, but they were participating in the defense, and they were participating in the settlement. They may not have had exclusive control, but they were participating.
They didn't have exclusive control of the defense nor the exclusive right to settle, so why would Stowers apply?
Stowers applies whenever there's a demand made within coverage. And then I thought where you were going with that question first was Stowers isn't going to apply because there's no coverage. And if there's no coverage, the insurance company can do nothing. The insurance company can say, there's no coverage. We really think there's not coverage here, and we're not going to pay it.
Does Stowers apply if the insured has the exclusive right to settle?
I believe,
and the exclusive control of the defense.
I believe it does,
if there were such a contract.
Yes, Jefferson, I'm not aware of an exception to Stowers. I think this was a good Stowers demand. Everyone in the underlying case, and in fact in this case, has conceded the demand that was made was a Stowers demand. So I think it did apply. The question is ultimately whether there was coverage. And that, in Matagorda County, this court put that decision back on the insurer because the insurer is in the business of making that decision.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Harris, there's a lot of discussion in lots of these cases about the eventual outcome, obviously whether there's coverage or not, and that's going to be important in a lot of things. But the way many of these cases arise is both sides are making a judgment, educated guess about risk at a time when they're unclear about coverage. So to paint this case in the prism of the eventual outcome determination of coverage seems to me to be completely irrelevant, at least to the issue of what the parties did at the time they took their action, given the facts at that time. I assume you agree.
I absolutely agree. You have to look at the rights of the parties at the time the actions are being taken. We know there's a coverage dispute. We know what the rights are under the contract. We know there's no right to reimbursement under the contract. So it's either going to have to be an express agreement, or in some jurisdictions they may allow an implied agreement. But you have to get an agreement of some fashion on reimbursement. Then you have the Stowers duty. We know that there's the ability to make a Stowers demand, and we know what the rights and obligations are there. And the insurance company in that position then makes the decision, is this case covered? If it's covered, I've got an indemnity obligation, and I need to do what a reasonable insurer would do, or I may be exposed to excess liability. Or is the case not covered, in which case I can do nothing, and I will have no indemnity obligation, and I will have no Stowers obligation for an excess liability, or fall somewhere in the middle. I don't really know if this case is covered or not, but I've got to make the decision, and I need to make the decision whether I think it's going to be covered or it's not going to be covered, and I need to make the decision how fearful I am of excess liability under Stowers, because under Stowers, that decision is put back on me as the insurance company, and if I don't make the right decision under Stowers, I have to suffer those consequences.
I believe you made the statement in your brief that the California cases that have gone the other way, Blue Ridge, for example, are distinguishable because underlying insurance considerations are different in California than they are in Texas. How is that?
Well, in Blue Ridge, the court there distinguished Matagorda County because in Blue Ridge they do not allow a declaratory judgment action, or in California. They do not allow declaratory judgment action before the underlying matter is resolved. And that's,
well, is it that they don't allow it, or they don't allow the insurer to take into account coverage in assessing the reasonableness of the offer?
I think those are two different things. I think they don't allow it to go forward. I guess you can file it, but it's to be stayed. And I don't think the declaratory judgment action can go forward. On not allowing coverage to be considered in the settlement demand, in Blue Ridge versus Jacobson, they use the word bad faith, and they refer to the Johansson decision. That's really the California equivalent of Stowers. Stowers' duties are very similar. There may be some slight nuances.
So when you say the policy differences between California and Texas, you're talking about the inability in California to push forward a deck action as you can in Texas.
That was how Blue Ridge distinguished Matagorda County. But the court in Blue Ridge also looked at some different factors. One of the factors that this court did not take into account in Matagorda County was the ability of the insured to go forward in the underlying litigation. In Blue Ridge, in crafting a rule allowing implied consent, they set up a three-part test that you have to meet before reimbursement will be allowed. There has to be a clear express reservation of rights. There has to be a notice to the insured that you're going to settle the case unless they object. And third, if they don't agree that the case ought to be settled, you then, as the insurer, have to tender the defense back to the insured. In other words, okay, you don't want to take my settlement, let me have reimbursement, then you go litigate the case. That is a valuable right that under the rule underwriters proposing in this case would be lost, because they say, we're going to settle the case, we are entitled to reimbursement, they settle the case, the insurer does not have the right to go forward in the underlying litigation.
Why is that?
Because they've settled the case, Judge. There is no underlying case any longer.
Well, I'm not sure I read Blue Ridge the same way you do. They just say that in California, they've been solicitous of the fact that they might have to stay any deck action. And I think that statement is probably true of Texas as well. I mean, you can stay a deck action for the same reasons. So
My reading of Blue Ridge, and I've done a little bit of reading on California law, and my understanding, and I may be wrong, I'll look at this, and if I am, I'll file a letter back with the court. But my understanding of California law is the general rule is that you do not allow the deck action to go forward while the underlying claim is pending. And if you look in the discussion of Matagorda County, I'm not sure if that's where you're reading in the back of the opinion where they talk about Matagorda. They say, well, in Texas, the Supreme Court said that the insurer has the ability to file a declaratory judgment action. But in California, what I thought it said is basically
unlike
we don't
the case
allow
in
that.
Texas, Blue Ridge did not have the opportunity.
So I think that's one of the distinctions. And the other big distinction in Blue Ridge is that they look out for the right of the insurer to be able to litigate the underlying case before they will imply, because that is an implied right of reimbursement, and before that's implied, they make sure that the insurer tenders the defense back to the insured so that the insured can litigate the case. And Judge Heck, the question you were asking about, well, how is that? That's the situation where I was talking about where the net worth of the corporate defendant may be $1 million. The settlement demand is for $7.5 million.
Well, I'm just kidding. It didn't seem like underwriters ever had the defense, and it didn't seem like Franks wanted to take the defense back, so I don't see how that third prong is the issue here. If they don't want the defense, which they have, they share it with their primary, I guess. But anyway, excess doesn't have it.
I agree, but the same principle allows the insured to litigate the underlying case. And if you look a page or so over from where they set up that three-part test, they even say, if the insurer thought there was no liability, they could have litigated the underlying case because the insurer gave them that opportunity. And that's the reason I think it's important to have the second element in Matagorda County to require consent, or if you're not going to do that, do something like the Supreme Court of California did in Blue Ridge. I think that's a much more nebulous test, and you're going to be litigating those factors. Whereas here we have a very clear rule, but that's one of the big problems is taking away from the insured that right to litigate the liability in the underlying case. Because instead of fixing the amount of damage at $7.5 million, if there's a 50-50 shot on liability, they may have no choice but to go forward on that.
But I guess what I don't understand is in this case, Franks never said, look, we want to go forward. We're going to beat this case. They were saying the opposite. We're going to get smushed. we've got to settle.
But the issue that I'm talking about got taken away because whenever underwriters said, we're going to get reimbursement, they sent that letter over on February 23rd, we're going to settle the case, we're going to get reimbursement, they then did settle the case and resolved it. But backing up a step, prior to that, the demands made by Franks were for the insurance company to settle the case under Stowers as a covered claim, which is different. And if you had turned the question back to Franks, okay, Franks, here's the situation. If we do settle this case for $7.5 million, if we come back after you for it, are you going to be able to pay that? Do you want to pay that, or do you want to go forward in the underlying case? See, that's what the second prong in California does. It makes the insurer put the insured on notice that they're going to settle the case.
The insurer said in this case, we want reimbursement. They put that on the record.
They did, and settled the case within 3 hours.
And you said, and we're not going to give it to you.
Well, we said that the next day after the case was settled. They said, we're going to come after you for reimbursement, and then they picked up the phone and settled the case.
But you went into court before it was settled and said, we want this settlement, knowing that claim for reimbursement was out there. I don't see how, if we applied the California test, you prevail. I mean, the test of California, you would lose because your client wanted to settle the case, had the opportunity to go forward with the litigation, had they so chosen, with their own defense. So why wouldn't you lose under the Blue Ridge test?
Well, Judge, I don't know that we could have stopped the settlement. They went into court on the morning of February 24th and read, if you look at the record, we're reading into the record the Rule 11 agreement. The case was settled.
Your point is, why would you stop the settlement? If as far as you know, you've got a covered claim because they haven't filed the deck action, why would you want to stop it if you feel like you're covered?
Well, that's right. You've got a situation, and that's the hard choice for the court. I think it's the ultimate decision that the court struggled with in Matagorda County. You've got the insurance company saying we want reimbursement, and you've got the insurer saying we're not going to give you reimbursement or remaining silent, whichever is the applicable situation. And then you have to come down to, is there an agreement? Is it implied in fact? No, because there's no meeting of the minds. Is it implied in law? And that's where all these equities come in. And that's where I think the Supreme Court in Matagorda County got it right in saying you need to consent to that because that takes care of the situation where you're taking basically the case away from the insured and depriving them of the right to litigate it. You're dealing with the different demands that are made when there's coverage, when there's not coverage. That's the right place to put the equities, and it also prevents eroding Stowers because if you have another rule and allow the insurer to unilaterally settle the case, cap at Stowers' liability, and then still go back after the insured for the money, it's a free Stowers ride for them. It takes Stowers out of the picture. And Stowers is in the picture there, as it is in every settlement decision.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I think Justice Hatch hit it on the head when he noted the fact that what Griffin and Gandy do is recognize that the DJ is justiciable, but that there are practical ramifications here that really have to be taken into consideration. And I would simply submit to the court that the remedy currently proposed by the court with Matagorda County doesn't work if what you're trying to do is, well, it works if you try to foster more litigation because there's nothing else that an insurer can do. And I don't understand what is wrong with a different system. Matagorda can stand on its facts. But in this situation where an excess carrier is not participating in the defense, I would still submit to the court that the record is clear. It did not participate in settlement despite the contentions to the contrary. We reacted to a settlement demand that was unilaterally negotiated and obtained. And if reaction to that and doing, capitulating and doing what you're assured demands that you do under threat of Stowers is participating in settlement negotiations, I think that's been redefined beyond meaningful.
And I realize it's not the record, but let's just say for purposes of argument that Franks had a net worth of $1 million. Then if we rule your way, they're out of business. When they were at a point negotiating when there was some argument there was coverage. I mean, you understand that they're in a difficult situation because the reason these high demands are coming in is this perception that there is coverage. I mean, the reason that the plaintiffs are demanding these amounts, if they knew there was no insurance, if this was a self-insured and the company was worth $1 million, the settlement demand is going to be $800,000 or $900,000.
That's you're absolutely correct, and that goes on all the time. And it goes on in situations where you can't, a DJ, saying you can file a DJ and resolve it, it just doesn't happen. I mean, you could do it and you could start the process. But
in this situation, if Excess attempted to collect this amount from Franks, and if hypothetically their net worth was $1 million, Franks is out of business. Whereas
right.
if there had not been coverage, they would be in business under that scenario.
Well, so you're saying that they're burdened with the aura of potential insurance coverage.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you'd acknowledge that. I mean, the plaintiff's lawyer wants to know, is there insurance money here or is there not? And that completely drives the settlement.
Absolutely. I acknowledge that that happens. I don't understand how that...
Especially Excess.
I don't understand how that relates to what my client did in this situation and how it is that by capitulating to demands that they lost a right recognized by this court under Griffin.
But you recognize the dilemma we're in as well. And I still haven't heard anything that if we were to decide your way, which I think would require us to tinker some with Matagorda, I could posit many scenarios where the inequities would go the other way.
Well, there are always...
I think we're struggling to come up with something that would be equitable both ways.
What I would suggest to the court in terms of equities both ways is I don't have... issue with Matagorda in the sense that the insurer injected itself into the process and controlled everything, all right, and then dealt with it. And that's consistent with the court's cases that culminated in Rocor, where the court gradually sort of has looked at that issue and said, if you're going to jump into settlement, even as an excess carrier, if you're going to do that, you do it right, and you need to make sure you do it with a view towards protecting your insured. Now, in our case, Mr. Harris correctly notes, it was an indemnity policy. We didn't even have to fund the settlement. You know, the excess insurers in this case timely reserved rights. They did it on a couple of occasions. The second time when there was more facts that became known to support additional basis for coverage determination and then capitulated to a demand by the insured to settle the case. And suddenly, a right that they had, that they had not waived, was gone. And under the circumstances of this case, I don't think that that's a necessary conclusion from looking at what happened in Matagorda County or what the court was, I think, concerned with in Matagorda County.
Thank you, counsel.
I have one quick question. Were there fact disputes on the coverage issue? And if so, are they in the record, what they were?
I believe that there are some things in the record on that point, Your Honor. In terms of the fact disputes, I'm drawing on memory here. The issue with respect to some of the coverage issues, I think, had to be developed, but I honestly can't tell the court with any precision an answer to that.
Well, when Judge Work made his determination, was it based on factual resolution or purely as a matter of law?
Well, I think there were some factual resolutions. It's always incorporated somehow, but I think that the facts weren't in great dispute. What I can't recall is whether the facts that were the basis of Judge Work's decision were facts that were apparent from the underlying pleadings or had been developed in the underlying litigation, which, of course, went all the way up to trial. So it was quite a bit of discovery that was conducted. There was a record there.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take another brief recess.
All right.